Hey folks, this is Tom Castles, former host of Databook. I just wanted to drop in for a second to let you know that today's episode is brought to you by InterSystems, the engine behind the world's most important healthcare applications. So here's the deal. InterSystems is all about helping you overcome the challenges of modern healthcare. Their advanced software solutions can help your health system transform care processes for moving to value-based care, managing population health, engaging patients, and so much more. It's all driven by a simple mission: to empower care providers and connect care communities around clearly presented, easy-to-use, and comprehensive health information. I think we can all agree that our industry needs innovation. So that's why I encourage you to take the next step today. Reach out to InterSystems on Twitter or LinkedIn, or visit them online at intersystems.com.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Databook. My name is Samara Rosenfeld, and today I will be speaking with Paul Serrato, former editor of Information Week Healthcare. Paul has more than 30 years of experience working as a research analyst, medical journalist, clinician, and educator, and has written extensively on clinical decision support, electronic health records, protected health information security, and practice management. His latest book, Reinventing Clinical Decision Support, is co-authored by Dr. John Halamka, the president of the Mayo Clinic platform. In part two of our two-part podcast, we will discuss the criticisms, obstacles, and limitations of the new diagnostic tools, if big data analytics can improve existing clinical decision support systems, and if AI-based tools will ultimately replace human diagnostic reasoning. Before listening to part two, please make sure you check out part one, where Paul spoke about his latest book, Reinventing Clinical Decision Support, the cause of diagnostic errors, and how machine learning can improve patient outcomes.
So, Paul, thank you again for joining us, and why don't we dive in?
Sounds good. As far as criticisms, obstacles, limitations to these new diagnostic tools and therapeutic tools, probably one of the biggest obstacles is the fact that the scientific evidence is not as strong for some of the other treatments and diagnostic tools that physicians are typically used to. Many of the studies involving machine learning and AI are retrospective studies. So they're looking back in time and analyzing data sets and patients with, let's say, eye disease or colon cancer, and applying the algorithm to historical records. So that's useful, but it's nowhere near as strong as prospective trials, where you look forward in time, because retrospective studies are more likely to have biases and don't quite reflect the real world. So one of the obstacles that needs to be addressed is the study methodology. We need more randomized controlled trials in order to satisfy those who make decisions about buying the software and using the software and so on. Even the data sets themselves that are being used, some of them have significant weaknesses. So for instance, let's say you're going to study a group of patients in San Diego at a hospital in San Diego, and you use that data set to train and to test machine learning algorithms. Is that data set representative of the entire United States population? Well, probably not. So what some more sophisticated investigators have done is they've used the exact same algorithms, and they've tested it on a population at another healthcare center, maybe 1,000 miles away, to see if the two results are the same. And sometimes they're not, and sometimes they are. So obviously, when you see consistency from one data set to another, you have more confidence that the software tools are useful. Then there's the other problem of biased data. Are you ignoring a certain important part of your patient population that was not represented? So are there enough African Americans in the study? Were there enough women in the study? Were enough transgender patients, and so on and so forth? If you're going to apply it in the real world, the patient population has to be consistent with the patient population that was studied in the original trial. And then last but not least is what I referred to last time as the explainability problem, the black box solution, or I should say the black box dilemma. Many of these programs are hard for physicians to understand. I mean, these programs are put together by data scientists who have a whole different set of skills, and technologists are not always very good at explaining their programs to the rest of us, mere humans. If you actually dig deep into these algorithms, sometimes you've got pages and pages of mathematical equations that the average clinician just doesn't understand. So one way to address that problem is education. And I'll give you an example. And I'm not talking about really complicated education. I'm talking about some basic stuff. So there is a video clip from PBS Nova program that explains how convolutional neural networks work. And essentially, it's about 2 minutes worth of a discussion given by a woman who's showing you what different dogs look like. So she'll take a picture of a dog with a hat on and another picture of a dog with a cape on and so on and so forth. And then she asks, so how can a computer recognize a dog? And then over the next 2 minutes, they have computer scientists explain in very simple language how it works. I gave a presentation using this video clip at Harvard Medical School last March to a select group. There were about 30 docs and healthcare executives from around the world. These are some of the smartest people in healthcare. When I finished with my presentation, I had people coming up to me saying, yeah, can I have a copy of your slides? Can I have a link to the PBS program? So you think about what that means. Even though these are the brainiacs in healthcare, they still found something as simple as a PBS video useful in understanding how machine learning and neural networks work. So there is a thirst, there is a need, there's an interest amongst clinicians. We just have to provide them with education that they can understand. JAMA is another good example of a group who has really gone out of their way to teach clinicians how to understand machine learning. They have a whole website in which there's a 20-minute video, for instance, that explains convolutional neural networks. And it's a little more in-depth, but it's clinician-friendly. So these are the type of tools that will eventually change the scenario and get docs and nurses on board.
When it comes to the clinical decision support systems that already exist, how can big data analytics improve them?
Data analytics is another one of those confusing set of tools that a lot of clinicians are not that comfortable with. But it is possible to use it to essentially reinvent clinical decision support. In our one of our HIMSS lectures in March of this coming year, we talk about the foundation upon which clinical decision support systems are based, and all the various systems, whether it's UpToDate or Clinical Key or Visual DX, most of them rely on a knowledge base that consists of the large clinical trials, clinical guidelines from major medical associations. Our contention is that some of the foundation upon which clinical decision support systems rest are flawed. One of the reasons they're flawed is because the clinical trials typically give you a one-size-fits-all answer. So you take, let's say you take 5,000 patients with diabetes and you give them an intensive lifestyle program, let's say, consisting of exercise and diet. And then you give a second group a control intervention. Sometimes what will happen, that's one particular example we use in our presentation, is the study investigators will come to the conclusion that there is no benefit to the treatment. There's actually one study called the Look-Ahead Study. They spent 9 years trying this intensive lifestyle program. And after 9 years, they says, nope, it's useless. So that kind of information is put into a clinical decision support system, and it influences docs who are asking, well, will these programs reduce the risk of heart disease and myocardial infarction? So that study suggests that they wouldn't. Okay, so along comes another investigator about 10 years later who says, well, let's take a deeper dive. Let's use something called random forest analysis. This is a type of machine learning that takes a much closer look at all the different subgroups that could be in the patient population. So typically, researchers will look at two or three subgroups to see if maybe they've missed something in the larger study. So they might look at patients above 65 years of age or African Americans or whatever. And if they find nothing, they'll say, okay, the results apply to everybody. Well, the newest study that used the random forest analysis looked at 85 different subgroups. You know, when you're dealing with computer algorithms, you can do this kind of a deep dive. They looked at 85 subgroups. They created 1,000 decision trees to break out all the different possible risk factors and variables that might influence patients when they were on this special diet. And what they found was really very revealing. They found that 85% of the patients benefited from the lifestyle improvement program. But on the other hand, 15% of the patients actually got worse. So when you factored in the 85% who benefited and the 15% who got worse, they canceled one another out, which explains why the original study said, oh, the treatment program is useless, when in fact it was very valuable for certain subgroups. So perfect example of how machine learning can totally reimagine clinical decision support systems. And this is just one example of, I think we have three or four of them in the book that show that machine learning, as it's used to improve data analytics, can have a profound effect on these clinical decision support systems.
Are clinicians interested in these technologies because of the possibility of improving outcomes, or are there other reasons why they might want to be using these?
Good question. They're interested for more than one reason. The main reason, I mean, as healthcare providers, you know, they take an oath to relieve human misery. And so the primary reason, I would say, is because they are looking for better clinical outcomes. But realistically, physicians and nurses are all also have to deal with metrics. You know, they have performance metrics that they have to meet, and more they have to prove that their diagnostic skills are as good as their neighbor's diagnostic skills. So there's money involved. You know, there's promotions involved in getting the diagnosis right. There's also lawsuits involved. I mean, these days when you miss an important diagnosis, the odds of you being sued for malpractice are very, very real. So using better clinical decision support systems will probably reduce the risk of malpractice. At least it would seem that way, just looking at it logically. So there's lots of reasons. And then there are business reasons. I'm sure that the decision makers in healthcare organizations, you know, the CEOs and the CIOs, who are considering using tools like this are asking, you know, what's my bottom line? Is it going to bring in more patients? Is it going to improve our financial situation? So there's lots of reasons.
When it comes to using AI, there has been a great fear that the technology will one day replace humans. Can you provide a little insight on that? Is this realistic? Will these AI-based diagnostic tools replace human diagnostic reasoning?
I don't think it ever will. Obviously, I don't have a crystal ball, so I really don't know what's going to happen down the road. But within the next 10 years, it seems very unlikely. Almost all the research points to one conclusion, and that is that AI and machine learning is going to assist clinicians in diagnosis and treatment, but it's not going to replace them, for the simple reason that no matter how wonderful AI is, it doesn't really substitute for human reasoning. We're just not there yet. Probably the most effective AI programs are in the area of image analysis. So what's happening there is a computer could look at, let's say, a picture of a skin lesion to determine whether or not it's melanoma or not. And the reason it's effective is because a computer can look at every single pixel in the image, whereas a human obviously can't. So it can pick out subtle changes that a human can't. But that's low-hanging fruit. The diagnostic process is far more complicated than that. You know, when you talk to experts in cardiology and oncology and various other areas, they are going through some mental gymnastics that are way more sophisticated than any computer is capable of doing. So bottom line is, computers are not doing they're not imitating one. They're not mimicking human intelligence on any significant level. That said, I have to conclude by saying, no, physicians are not going to be replaced by AI. But physicians who use AI and use machine learning are probably going to replace physicians who are not. Those who remain dinosaurs, those who continue to ignore what's going on in the field of clinical informatics, they're probably going to be phased out, or at least slowly but surely they're going to be replaced by docs who are willing to embrace this future, essentially.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time and for, you know, providing us enough insights for two full information-packed podcasts. I really appreciate it. And, you know, I'm looking forward to hearing more about your work at HIMSS.
Thank you very much.
Patient Experience Symposium is a one-of-a-kind conference that brings together leading stakeholders from across healthcare to improve and enhance patient experience. The most influential thought leaders, healthcare executives, clinical trial operators, and clinicians will come together in Massachusetts from May 11th to 13th to exchange game-changing ideas and actionable strategies to enhance patient experience in their healthcare ecosystems. The symposium features a new track, The Role of New Technologies in Healthcare, which will include a session titled Telehealth, Improving the Patient Experience and Enhancing Care, featuring Dr. Joseph Kvader, and Digital Therapeutics, Combining Technology and Evidence-Based Medicine to Transform Personalized Patient Care, featuring Megan Coder. Attendees will learn best practices and find answers to difficult patient experience issues and leave with the power to develop an unforgettable patient experience. To register and learn more, go to patientsymposium.com. Together, we're changing the face of patient experience. Thank you so much for tuning in to this week's episode of Databook. As always, I'm your host, Samara Rosenfeld. Make sure you like this podcast, subscribe, and follow Inside Digital Health on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook to stay up to date on the latest health tech news. Also, feel free to follow me on Twitter, @RosenfeldSamara, and let me know what you want to hear on the upcoming episodes of the show.
Hey folks, this is Tom Castles, former host of Databook. I just wanted to drop in for a second to let you know that today's episode is brought to you by InterSystems, the engine behind the world's most important healthcare applications. So here's the deal. InterSystems is all about helping you overcome the challenges of modern healthcare. Their advanced software solutions can help your health system transform care processes for moving to value-based care, managing population health, engaging patients, and so much more. It's all driven by a simple mission: to empower care providers and connect care communities around clearly presented, easy to use, and comprehensive health information. I think we can all agree that our industry needs innovation. So that's why I encourage you to take the next step today. Reach out to InterSystems on Twitter or LinkedIn, or visit them online at intersystems.com.